Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Universal, Google and the Wu-Tang Clan. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me, it's Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
I think we should insert a disclaimer to this edition of the podcast.
Are you going to complain about my intonation of Wu-Tang Clan?
No, I wasn't going to bring that up.
As you were just now before we started.
I'm still not convinced you quite said it right in the intro there.
The Wu-Tang Clan.
I think it could be better, but that wasn't what I was going to insert a disclaimer about.
The Wu-Tang Clan.
Oh, no, not that. Whatever you do, never say that again.
It was a bit of a sharp drop.
I don't even know what that meant.
Wu-Tang Clan.
These are all just nonsense sounds to me now. They make no sense.
The Wu-Tang Clan, that's not a nonsense sound. Wu-Tang is a very serious sound.
The disclaimer
is
that we're on a very tight deadline today. Mm. We're always on a tight deadline.
That's our disclaimer every week.
No, but I've got a specific subset to the disclaimer. As well as being on a very tight deadline.
You always make it sound like we've broken in. They're going to find us out soon.
Yeah, the alarm's on a 40-minute delay. So we're on a very tight deadline this week. As a result of that, Matt was unable to make us a coffee.
Right.
And he makes very fine coffee. So this is not caffeine-fueled like it normally would be. So if we aren't quite as fluid as normal, it's because of the
I haven't had any caffeine since 7 a.m.
Have you not?
And it is now 20 past one.
I bought a new coffee machine this week.
Blimey.
Because my old coffee machine... Well, first of all, that's a lot posher than it is. It's just a, like, you know, an old-fashioned water drips through some coffee.
Oh, I thought you were going to say it's a cafetiere.
Thing. It's slightly more sophisticated than a cafetiere, but not an espresso maker or an espresso machine or anything like that. It's a very simple water drips through into the thing.
I know,
machine.
A filter coffee machine.
And the one I had, which I have next to my desk, because the Senior Daily is caffeine-fueled as well as the Setlist.
Do you not have it on a drip yet?
And it was quite old, and I'd never cleaned it. In fact, first of all, it was taking about an hour to make coffee.
Oh my God.
Plus, it was just getting noisier and noisier. It was actually noisier than an espresso machine, even though it's just dripping coffee. So it got to the point where I think I need to get rid of this. Well, before I decided to buy a new one,
cleaned.
Well, I Googled how do you clean a coffee machine.
Yeah.
And all the articles I could find talked about how at least every month you should be doing a full wash in addition to the wash that you do every day after you've made a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
And having never done that for about 4 years, I thought probably let's just not even embark on this and buy a new coffee machine.
Well, this was, having just said that we were on quite a tight deadline, that was an unnecessary diversion into talk of coffee machines. However, we have just learnt that at least one of the presenters of this podcast is disgusting.
Well, really?
I mean, you've got to clean your coffee machine.
Well, I mean,
that's a rule.
I clean the jug and I take out the filters and throw them away. It's not that there were 4 years' worth of coffee granules in there. I would give it that.
I realised that, but at first I thought that's what you meant.
It's limescale that I've not been getting rid of. So now my coffee tastes quite different. I'm no longer getting coffee with an extra shot of...
mostly limescale.
Limescale.
So, I need to descale my coffee machine.
Yeah, I don't because I bought a new one this week.
Thanks for reminding me. And anyway, should we...
According to Google, I don't need to descale it for at least 6 weeks.
We're going to talk about Google in a bit.
Or four
Look at
years.
That transition.
It is.
We're talking about Google this week and its new rules on secondary ticketers who want to advertise on the AdWords platform. We're also going to talk about the Wu-Tang Clan beef with a dog walking business. It's going to be one of those shows. But first, let's talk about Universal, the Universal Music Group, to give it its full name.
Yeah, not the Universal Movie Studio.
No.
If that's what you were hoping, you're going to be very disappointed by this podcast.
No. So because at a conference in Barcelona recently, the Vivendi boss, Arnaud de Puyfontaine, claimed that Universal Music now has a valuation of $40 billion.
Now, he is, I believe, French, and the conference was in Spain. So do you think he actually said $40 billion?
No, he probably said something in euros.
But...
the previous valuation that came out was in euros. It was 20 billion euros.
Now, to be fair to Mr. Vivendi, let's call him Mr. Vivendi, just for the purposes of
today. He does have quite a complicated surname.
Do you know that Vivendi. Sorry, I'm now dropping in random Vivendi facts. Do you want a random Vivendi
fact?
Sure,
yeah, all right, let's get that out of the way.
Vivendi was originally a water company. Yes. It almost links into what we were just talking about.
It would do if we were talking about coffee now.
Well, we were talking about limescale and water and all of that, weren't we?
There was no limescale in Vivendi's water. Well, maybe that's why they got out of the water business.
Perhaps
actually,
it was. That's why no one was buying their water. It Scandal. Was founded by Napoleon III, Vivendi.
Was it?
So it's quite an old company. Mm. I don't think Napoleon III, when he founded that company, anticipated that one day his business would consist of a major record company and a French TV station. But
I'm sure it's what he was hoping for.
That is what his business ventures have brought us to. So yes, Mr. Vivendi was citing somebody else's figure. So he wasn't actually saying, we've done some maths, we've crunched the figures, and we're saying that Universal Music is now worth $40 billion. He was sort of just sort of musing and saying, well, I heard somebody say, and I don't think he actually said who, which is suspicious, given that the valuation we had earlier in the year was about $23 billion.
23.5.
If we're going for American dollars. But he was sort of saying, I've heard somebody thought that it might now be worth more than $40 billion.
So the $23.5 billion valuation was one that quite a lot of analysts thought was a bit over the top.
Majorly over the top, not like double what it's really worth, but still at the upper end of a reasonable estimate.
Yeah, so 40 billion, quite a lot. And Mr. De Puyfontaine, or Mr. Vivendi, Mr. Vivendi's easier.
It is a lot easier.
Mr. Vivendi, it did concede that 40 billion was higher than the highest valuation that is currently expressed by the markets. But when asked if he felt that the 40 billion valuation was valid and that Universal Music was worth that, he said yes. So I think we have to go with that now.
Yes, that's it decided. Now, you might be wondering, why are people both in Barcelona this month and somewhere else earlier in the year talking about a valuation for the Universal Music Group, which I suppose consists of various things. It consists of all of the Universal record companies. It consists of the Universal Music Publishing Company. It consists of the Bravado Merchandise Company. And I suppose it's worth remembering, Universal Music, biggest record company in the world.
Yep.
Universal Music Publishing, second biggest music publisher in the world. Bravado, biggest merchandise company in the world. And then they've got a few other things in there as well, haven't they? The Abbey Road Studios and stuff like that in that group. Wholly owned by Vivendi, outright, at the moment.
At the moment.
And when businesses are outright owned by a parent company, well, why are we even bothering to try and put a valuation onto them? Surely all that matters is, what are the revenues coming in quarter to quarter? How much profit are we making? How much is being handed up to the parent company? Who cares how much the actual business is worth? You would only want to know that if you are planning on selling it.
Yes, I mean, because aside from bragging purposes, it has been speculated of late that Vivendi is planning to put some of the business on the stock market, in which case a valuation is an important thing.
So this rumour has been doing the rounds for a while. It's worth noting that the Vivendi board, including Mr. Vivendi, who we're talking about here, have all said that is not on our short-term agenda. There is not going to be a flotation of Universal Music, certainly not in its whole, but even part of the company. We are not going to float it on the stock exchange anytime soon. And they've said that several times now. Although whenever they say that, they then provide a get out.
Yeah, and their get out is basically, well, never say never, who knows.
And so therefore, gossipers in the investment community take that get out as saying, aha, perhaps they are going to float a slice of Universal Music at some point in the near future. And I suppose another reason why people are talking about the valuation of Universal Music as the biggest music rights company in the world and the biggest record company in the world is people are talking about the fact that analysts in investment circles in the city at Wall Street are increasingly optimistic about the music rights sector. So that side of the music industry that deals in recordings and songs and copyright, which obviously, particularly when it comes to recordings, had a really bad decade between 2000 and 2010. But we've been talking quite a bit on the podcast in the last couple of years about how the record industry is now back into growth.
Yes.
The IFPI, the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry, when they put out their stats earlier this year, they were very keen to stress, yes, we're back into growth, but we've got a long way to go before we get back to the peak of where the record industry was in terms of revenues at the end of the 1990s. But things are back into growth, and so therefore, some people are saying, because the sector's back in growth, there's renewed optimism about music rights. What does that mean about the biggest music rights company? Does that mean that for Universal, the only way is up? They're going to keep growing and growing and growing And therefore, this is going to become a really valuable company in 10 years' time.
Well, yeah, so at the moment, if the record industry is back in growth, there's all this optimism. So actually, this isn't the point, really, that it would be wise for Vivendi to start thinking about selling off a bit of Universal. You want to wait until it's grown a bit more and you can get more money for it.
Yeah, exactly. Unless they're really desperate for the cash, which they're not really at the moment, then you're right. Why would you do the flotation now? Wait until it's gained a bit more momentum. Maybe until you think, oh, we're about to peak. And at that point, it would be worth floating a little bit on a stock exchange, which might be one of the reasons behind what they're saying, is that perhaps in the back of their minds, they may be thinking, actually, in 5 years' time, floating 20% of this company might be a really good idea. So that's why we're not going to rule it out entirely, but I think it would be mad for them to do it now.
But in the meantime, why not talk up your valuation, get people interested at this stage? There are a few potential issues.
With all this optimism?
Yes, because obviously, well, number one, as we always say, all this optimism is based on the money being pumped into the record industry by streaming, and no streaming company has yet made a profit. So it's all based on companies that are a bit unstable.
Yes. So although officially the record industry is excited and optimistic because we're getting bigger, the revenues are going up, if you want to be a pessimist in music, and actually when I have this conversation at events and seminars and conferences, I would say the majority of the people working in music are optimistic, or at least they want to be optimistic. And I suppose well, you would be, wouldn't you? Because your career depends on this industry growing and being successful. Although there is a minority who are pessimistic about the fact that none of these streaming services are making any money. They're all actually making quite significant losses. So you could see to an extent that's a subsidy of the record industry. They are using up venture capital money, money they've borrowed off the banks, pumping a big chunk of that in royalties into the record industry and into the music publishing sector, and they are making these huge losses. That is clearly not sustainable. So can these services ultimately go into profit? I would suspect that most of them can't, actually. But I suppose the music industry doesn't need all of them to succeed. It just needs some of them to succeed. So can the key players, and I suppose when it comes to premium...
Someone was saying, I read an interview with someone, an executive, I can't remember who it was now, but he was saying there needs to be five. There needs to be five successful streaming services.
Worldwide.
Worldwide, and then we'll be fine.
Then we'll be fine. I mean, obviously, when it comes to sort of the classic...
I mean, major ones. I assume he wasn't including the niche ones in that. But yes, like five major ones, and that will do us fine.
In terms of paid-for streaming, which is what is generating most of the money, I have to think the only two that currently have the momentum to reach the scale I think they need to reach in order to be viable long term is Spotify and Apple. As we've said at various points, Amazon could come up behind and sort of catch up with Spotify and Apple. But really, that is it worldwide. It may be that some of those services that are big in certain Asian markets like QQ in China maybe will become significant either because those markets will just grow and become more lucrative and therefore they'll be passing in lots of money, or perhaps they will go global as well. So are you optimistic that at least five, or however many it is that we need, will reach the scale where they will be profitable? Or do you think it's still all to play for and we could get to a point in a couple of years' time where Spotify and Apple, who have had all of this impressive subscriber growth in the last couple of years, start to plateau and they're simply not big enough? And then, well, what's plan B? There isn't a plan B. So right. So therefore, there is room for pessimism. And I suppose if you are Universal Music, you are predominantly in the music rights business, a bit of merch on the side, but predominantly it's recordings and songs. And so your future is locked to those companies' future. So if you want to be pessimistic about the streaming sector, that is a reason to be pessimistic about the future of Universal, even if at the moment the quarterly financial reports keep going up, up, up.
All right, but let's be optimistic, because there is no plan B. So let's be optimistic and assume that the streaming services are, they're all going to go into profit. It's all going to be fine.
All of them.
All of them.
Every single one,
even Tidal, and it'll all be brilliant. However, even if that happens, the labels are already under pressure to give up some of their considerable share of the royalties that come into the music industry to artists and publishers and songwriters who are on, well, the publishers and songwriters particularly, on much smaller cuts than the record label side.
Yes, so if you want a second reason to caution optimism in Universal Music's growth up to a $40 billion valuation, is that very point, that all this money that's coming in from the streaming sector gets shared up between all the stakeholders in music. So I suppose there are four main stakeholders in the music community: the artists and their labels, and the songwriters and their publishers. Obviously, there are also distributors and collecting societies in the mix there, and they are all sharing the money. And as it currently stands, most of the money goes to the record companies, then probably next artists and songwriters, and probably next the publishers. All of that is subject to contract. So there are so many variables in that. But labels are certainly seeing more than everybody else. And obviously, as we have discussed at various points, also it's discussed in the Dissecting Digital Dollar reports that the MMF published, that we produced, most artists, most songwriters, most publishers think the labels are getting too much of this money and there should be a redistribution of that money. And quite how that happens is complicated, but I think the more the streaming business booms and the more the record companies see their revenues and their profits go up, the more pressure is going to come onto these companies, and Universal in particular is the biggest, to share more of that money, which will mean two things: sharing more with the songwriters and publishers, so allocating more of the money to the song copyright rather than the recording copyright. Now, you could say, well, Universal's a label and a publisher, so what do they care?
You could.
Well, why don't you?
All right, Universal's a label and a publisher, so what do they care?
Well, they care because of the way record deals and publishing deals are structured. Because traditionally, when you sign to a major music company, on a record deal, the label will keep the vast majority of the money under that deal, because they make a big investment and do lots of marketing, etc., etc. Whereas on a publishing deal, traditionally, because the advances weren't so high and because you didn't tend to spend all the marketing money, it will be the other way around. The publisher will keep a minority of the money and the songwriter will get the majority. So if you are a music rights company that has both a label and a publisher, you would prefer all the money to go through your label because you get to keep more of it. And then, of course, there's the question of how much do the artists receive. That's generally subject to contract. But there are various movements afoot that says the artist should be seeing more of this money. Now, will that be achieved through reform of copyright law to sort of give power to the artists as they seek to renegotiate old deals, or to see perhaps some of that money come through the collective licensing system? And when it comes to new deals, it's all about these new distributors and label services companies, the new kinds of businesses who are offering similar services to labels, but often on very different terms. And if, as artists have more choice, as we talked about on last week's set list, as artists have more choice as to who they work with as business partners, perhaps they'll start working more with distributors and label services companies. And Universal, in order to compete, we'll have to start saying to artists, all right then, we're currently offering you 18% of streaming income. How about 20%? How about 25%? How about 30%? So actually, the amount of money Universal hangs on to could decline over the next couple of decades.
And there's also one more thing hanging over, which is the reversion right in the US.
The good old termination right of copyright under American copyright law,
which allows artists to take back their rights in the US after 35 years, started to see that kick in for reasons we've discussed before and we don't need to go into now. But it could mean that labels start to see some of their big cash cow legacy catalogues drop off their roster. And that could be an issue depending on whether or not they manage to convince big artists to re-sign new deals with them, or those artists take their catalogues elsewhere.
Yeah, because this reversion right or termination right, whatever you want to call it, has only recently kicked in, because it's a bit of law that's 35 years old, so the 35-year thing has only just kicked in. Actually, although it's old law, it's 1970s copyright law, these reversions, these terminations are only just starting now. And as with all things to do with law, no one's quite sure quite to what extent these reversion rights apply, when they do apply, when they don't apply, what the technicalities are. And in music publishing, we have now got some clarity as to how songwriters reclaim their rights. When it comes to recordings, there's still a lot of debate. I mean, some labels would argue the reversion right doesn't even apply to sound recordings at all. But I think there are some test cases to come to work out exactly how does the termination right work in America. Of course, there's the ongoing debate, can European artists reclaim their American rights? So all of that is still TBC. But if those rulings and disputes all swing in the artists' and songwriters' favour, which I'm not saying they will, but if they did, yeah, lots of things combining here. Can the streaming boom be maintained? Will labels and publishers be forced to offer songwriters and artists ever better deals, either through competition or through copyright law? And what will ultimately happen as the termination right and reversion right becomes the norm in the US? So if you want to be a pessimist, help yourself. You can have that on us. Meanwhile, as you say, without a shadow of a doubt, Universal Music, definitely worth $40 billion.
Well, you can say that all these variables would account for why valuations can be so wildly different. And it remains to be seen whether Vivendi will decide to float a bit or all of Universal or not.
You could say, although it may be a double bluff, that the fact they don't want to float now, perhaps because they think they could make more money in 5 years' time, means that they are also optimistic. Because if they thought all this optimism floating around was hype, then it would be like, well, let's cash in now.
Yeah.
While all this hype's happening, and while Goldman Sachs is predicting a fivefold increase of streaming, and not wait until it turns out that that's all nonsense. So that would probably suggest that they are also optimistic about where things are going. But that doesn't necessarily mean that optimism is well-founded.
No. We'll see. Still to come, some news in brief, plus confirmation that Method Man is not going to walk your dog. But now, Google has announced that it is updating its policy on adverts taken out via the Google Ads system by secondary ticketing companies, and these new rules will come into effect early next year. So basically, any secondary ticketing company who wants to advertise on AdWords is going to have to be more clear that they are reselling tickets, they're not the primary seller, and about the prices that buyers could end up paying for those tickets.
So this announcement from Google has been welcomed by those in the music community who don't like ticket touting and don't like the second ticketing platforms, because it responds to an issue that has actually been raised at several points, actually particularly this year, as the whole ticket touting campaign has continued to gain momentum. So here in the UK, the Fanfare Alliance, they issued a little mini report on this earlier this year, where they said that many consumers, if they know one of their favourite artists is touring and they want to buy tickets, well, a big chunk of consumers, the first thing they will do is they will go into Google, they will Google artist name, tour, tickets, and then they'll see what happens in the Google search. And because obviously with Google search, some of the things you see in that search results list are there organically, some of them are paid to be there. But not everybody knows that. And so some people will assume that whatever comes at top of the list is obviously the most legit, most official place to go and buy my tickets, because why is it at the top of the list? Well, it's at the top of the list because somebody paid for it to be there. But a lot of consumers don't necessarily know that. And then you add on top of that, that some of these secondary sites, and Viagogo, unsurprisingly, is the biggest offender of this, deliberately write the blurbs that appear in those adverts on the Google search results to make it sound like they are actually a primary seller, an official seller, using, you know, clever little tactics like saying they're an official site, but other things as well that are slightly more subtle to suggest to people, yeah, this is where you get your official tickets, when in fact it's a platform where touts are selling those tickets at a markup. And that means that sometimes people are buying tickets at a markup when if they only went to the Ticketmaster primary site or to C-Tickets or to any of the independent ticket sites who are selling tickets, they could still get them cheaper at the face value price.
So what's changing is that from January, ticket resellers will have to be certified by Google before they can advertise on AdWords. And then once they're certified, they will have to stick to certain rules.
Yeah, condition of certification.
In order to be allowed to continue to advertise.
And interestingly, some of those rules that they will have to sign up to in order to get this certification are things already in the Consumer Rights Act here in the UK, but which campaigners argue that touts and the platforms they use have not been very good at enforcing. So perhaps it will help enforce those rules that are already in UK law. But crucially, these will apply globally. So in countries where there isn't a little bit of regulation of second ticketing in consumer rights law, Google will be enforcing this nevertheless. So this has global ramifications.
So what are they agreeing to?
Well, the first and most important thing is what we just talked about, which is not implying that they are an official primary seller when in fact they're a dodgy tout marking your tickets up. So being really clear, this is a resale platform. You are not buying off an official seller. Also being really clear on what that does to the price, which is, OK, we're selling you this ticket for this much, but FYI, the original ticket was this price and this is the markup. And then there's a little extra going in, isn't there? Something to do with declaring that in the same currency. So I assume that means some people must confuse people further by declaring the face value in one currency and then the upsell price in another currency.
That's something that's coming in later. In March, they'll have to state the original face value of the ticket next to the resale price and, yes, in the same currency, so as not to confuse matters there. They'll also have to show the total price for the tickets being resold, including any additional fees and taxes, before payment information is entered during the checkout process, because that's something that Viagogo have been accused of sort of at the very end of the process coming up and saying, hey, you just bought some tickets for this amount of money, and it's a lot higher than the person was expecting.
Because obviously the booking fees, the commissions charged by the secondary sites are significant and a lot more significant than on the primary sites, often double. So the booking fee that a primary site would charge you when you go to a secondary site, there will also be a booking fee. People are used to seeing that, but what they won't necessarily realise is it's double what you would normally expect. So yeah, these new rules will go live in the new year, there. As you say, some of them will then be added a couple of months later. So it'll be interesting to see how rigorously Google enforces these rules. But certainly the Fanfare Alliance here in the UK were very pleased with this development, and they were hopeful that it might actually force the second ticketing sellers to be more transparent. Obviously, it doesn't stop touting.
No.
But to just be clearer to consumers, you are buying a ticket off a tout and it is this much more expensive than it would have been had you bought it at face value. And I suppose then, I mean, obviously, the seller's not going to say this. Google's not going to say this. So there is still education to be done on the part of the music community of saying, this is a touted ticket. This is how much more it is going to be than face value. So maybe you should go back to your Google search and just check that there aren't any tickets still available on the primary sites where you could save some money before you do this purchase.
Yeah, so I think it has the potential to have a significant effect, but that's something we will see in the new year, whether it does. Just quickly, time for some news in brief now. Some MPs are backing a new campaign launched by UK Music to have the Agent of Change principle introduced into UK law. It follows UK Music expressing its disappointment that that did not feature in the Queen's speech when the current government came into power.
Yeah, even though the so-called Agent of Change principle, which basically says that if you're a property developer and you put a whole lot of residential flats next to an existing music venue, it's your job to make sure that the residential flats are soundproofed so there aren't any subsequent problems down the line, rather than just building them as you normally would and then running away and then allowing the future residents to then complain to the council and make licensing nightmare for the original venue. There has been lots of support for this Agent of Change principle in the political community over the last couple of years since it sort of was added as a talking point. Do you remember Martin Elbum, the founder of The Great Escape?
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I think it was after the 2015 election at The Great Escape. We got various music industry people to say, what is the one thing you would say to the new government? Because he'd been doing some work in Australia where this has already started to be introduced. He was like, yeah, that's the one thing I would say to the government. Let's get Agent of Change into the rule book. And I think at that point, most people in the room was like, I have no idea what you mean by Agent of Change. But lots of people have been talking about it more recently. There is quite a lot of political support for it. But I suppose it's a reminder that however much people in the political community sort of respond positively to what you're saying, say, yeah, we should do that, is you have to keep up the pressure till they've actually done it. Because it does sort of feel like there have been discussions in Westminster in the last couple of years where everyone's agreed we should do this, but it hasn't happened. So we need to keep up the pressure. And so various MPs are going to bring it up in the House of Commons in the new year. But there was a little bit of inclination from government ministers that actually, even though it wasn't in the Queen's speech, they are looking into trying to do something around this anyway.
Amazon is reportedly abandoning its bid to enter the US ticketing market after it's discovered what all ticketing startups find, that Ticketmaster and Live Nation really have their market sewn up.
Yeah, particularly in the US, they are particularly dominant. This is according to a live music industry website called Amplify, who cite various sources. So Amazon launched a ticketing company here in the UK a couple of years ago. That still exists. It's still growing. They're still adding more shows and festivals to their books. But then we heard the reports it worked well in the UK. Amazon was now going to roll this out around the world, and they were going to go into the US, obviously big market for live music. But it seems to be they tried to do a partnership deal with Ticketmaster that didn't come through for various reasons. They then investigated, well, can we go into competition with Ticketmaster in the US? And certainly sources talking to Amplify were saying no. And so apparently they're putting their American ticketing ambitions on the back burner, but still active here in the UK and may well roll it out into other territories.
PayPal has dropped its trademark litigation against Pandora, in which it basically accused the streaming service of copying its logo.
So earlier this year, PayPal went legal and said that that was basically Pandora breaching their trademark. They basically cited a whole load of tweets of people who were confused because they had a PayPal app and a Pandora app on their phone. Now the two icons for the apps look quite similar.
Yeah, and they tried to pay for something with Pandora.
And so they cited this confusion. They said Pandora should be forced to change their new logo. But out of court settlement, confidential, so we do not know what was agreed, but it ain't going to be fought through the courts.
So for more on all of those stories and everything discussed on this episode, you can go to setlistpodcast.com and the show notes for this show, where you will find links to them all. And finally this week, a New York dog walking business called Wu-Tang Clan has found itself in a spot of bother with Wu-Tang Clan founder The RZA.
So this is more trademark litigation here.
And hopefully it will be less disappointing than the damp squib of that PayPal litigation. This news was broken by the New York Daily News. They interviewed the founder of this dog walking business, who said, "I'm a fan. We walk dogs. I thought it was a good idea." And to be fair, it's a pretty good name. So good that he's not actually the only person to use it, although he is the first, apparently, to try to trademark it, and that is where the problem lies.
Yeah, you found a dog sled team in Alaska that has also adopted this moniker.
Yes, who also have a spin-off line of merch.
Yeah, well, you'd think...
really, really does look quite a lot like Wu-Tang Clan's WuWear merch.
And given they like their merch, and weren't they announcing recently that they were going to ramp it up again?
Yeah.
So you'd think they would be cracking down on that, not the dog walking company.
Well, we'll see, when they try to trademark it, that's when it all comes down.
But yes, this New York company that walks dog for a living is at the receiving end of legal threats from the Wu-Tang Clan. And I suppose, as is often the case when you have trademark disputes, well, with trademark law, there's two elements to it, okay? It's a body of intellectual property like copyright, so it is rewarding creativity and effort, etc. But there's also a consumer confusion element to trademark law, that it's about ensuring that consumers aren't confused, that they're buying a product that they think is allied to one company or person, when in fact it's allied to a different company or person. And I suppose that was where the Pandora PayPal thing was coming from, is consumers are confused, and so therefore that is why trademark law should intervene here, to stop the confusion. So therefore, RZA needs to convince the trademark registry that the people of New York are convinced that this dog walking company is somehow officially allied to the Wu-Tang Clan.
Yes, because the confusion is not that people are confused between the Wu-Tang Clan and the Wu-Tang Clan's actual dog walking business, because the Wu-Tang Clan do not have their own dog walking business.
Yet.
As far as well, maybe they're planning to launch one. I mean, who knows? Maybe that's what this is all about. But as far as we know, yeah, the confusion lies in that RZA thinks that people are going to think that this dog walking business has been officially endorsed by the Wu-Tang Clan, which I'm not sure anyone would. Especially if you look at the website, where it's like, you know, like it's all done in crayon. It's like it doesn't look like an official Wu-Tang website.
Yeah, unlike that dog sled company where their merch is clearly aping Wu-Tang's merch.
Yeah.
Whereas here, other than the pun in the name, there's nothing about their branding to suggest that there is any official alliance with the hip-hop outfit.
There was some straight-up infringement amongst all this hoo-ha, in that the dog walking business was selling its own line of merch, which was classic album covers on T-shirts, but with the rappers replaced by dogs. Those have all been taken off the website. I mean, it wasn't just Wu-Tang.
I was going to say, was it Wu-Tang albums?
There was a variety of stuff. There was
all like hip-hop?
All hip-hop, yeah. There's a very hip-hop themed company. One of the stipulations for choosing dogs that they will work with is that the owners have to agree that Illmatic by Nas is the greatest album of all time.
Also like the notion of them choosing dogs they're willing to work with. So the point is that unlike this dog sled team, that merch wasn't directly ripping off Wu-Tang's brand, but it was ripping off hip-hop artwork, including
Wu-Tang members. And like, there was an Old Dirty Bastard album, but there was a De La Soul album in there, but that's all disappeared. It's all gone. If you go to the shop section of the website now, there's nothing in it.
Which, as you say, could be linked to the trademark complaint by the Wu-Tang Clan. Although, I suppose that is actually using copyright rather than trademark, if it's the actual artwork and photography. And under copyright law, of course, there is the parody exception. And I suspect that they would be covered on that, because they would say, well, we're sending up these artists by putting dogs. Was there a Snoop Dogg cover? Was that in there?
I don't know. I only had screen grabs to go on.
So you don't know whether or not that was... that may be where it began. Who knows? But there may be a parody exception there. That doesn't generally apply on the trademark side. But let's hope that... it would have been nice had RZA just decided that he was going to endorse this company, even though they hadn't been asked to endorse.
Yeah.
That would have been a nice, funny story. But as he's decided to go for the petty, petulant, let's try and sue them out of business route, let's hope it does actually get to court, because it would be quite an amusing...
It would be funny. And I really hope that the dog walking business wins. I don't think it will. But
well, except that, I mean, if it got to court, they might have a case. But it seems unlikely they will have the funds and the resources or the will to fight it if they really have to.
Well, that's all we've got time for this week. If you enjoyed this episode, why don't you tell some people any way that you can. You can also follow us on all of the social media. Not all of the social media, some of the social media.
We're not on Snapchat.
We're not on Snapchat. You can email us your music business questions or just photos of your dog dressed as a rapper to setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk.
I don't have a dog.
Well, I wasn't talking to you directly.
I could dress up my coffee machine as a rapper.
Yeah, you could do that.
I'll email it in.
All right, do so. This show is presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. For more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.